Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah, we started to burn too many things we found. That's the glorious Darwinian scene with Pete Seeger and David Byrne's Solartopia song. This is Harvey Wasserman back with you for another half hour in the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Glad you are joining us. We're going to talk today about energy and energy policy. First, we're going to start with Ohio, which is the bellwether state in which decisions are being made. They're going to affect the entire country and the rest of our history as we try to shut the two remaining nuclear plants here in the Buckeye State, get them down, get them discontinued, decommissioned, the whole deal, get those people working on something, the 1,200 or so working at the two nuclear plants in Ohio, get them decent jobs. And then we're going to be joined by Pat Morita of the Sierra Club. Pat, you with us?
Yeah, hi, Harvey.
Hi there. And Ned Ford, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, you guys are both here on time. We're all in Ohio. It's very rare I have all my guests and me in the same state. But I'm in Pat and I are in Columbus in central Ohio. Ned's in Cincinnati area in southern Ohio. And so we're going to talk about what's going on here because it is of national importance, international importance, really, where Ohio is about to make a decision that's going to affect its energy policy and the country's for all time to come. And then at the half hour, both of you are welcome to stay. We're going to be joined by my old friend Mark Sommer, also from Columbus, but he's in the California now. We're going to talk about microgrids and the future of small-scale generating and transmission. So let's start here. We have had in this country now the catastrophic decision by two states, although they're being challenged, thankfully, in court in Illinois and in New York to bail out nuclear power plants, which are completely uncompetitive and losing tons of money. But the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has stepped in to twist the arm of the regulators and get $7.6 billion. Absolutely insane to keep four reactors operating. And then in Illinois, three reactors. The Republican governor, Bruce something or other, Rainer, I think is his name, has conspired to get about $2.5 billion for three nuclear plants there, although the package in Illinois also contains quite a lot of money for energy efficiency and other green programs. Now, in Ohio, it's gone back and forth, back and forth. And Ned, do you want to update us, Ned and Pat, on where we stand in Ohio on the massive bailouts that have been proposed by First Energy for the nuclear plants on the their big mistakes by the lake? Which one of you wants to jump in here?
Harvey, I'll try. That doesn't mean I want to do this. The picture is very complicated in Ohio. There are three utilities that have sought some form of bailout, and several of them have sought more than one form of bailout in more than one case. There are coal bailouts, there are nuclear bailouts, and then there's these OVEC plants, the Ohio Valley Electric Corporation, which was formed in the 1950s. To provide electricity to the piped-in uranium enrichment facility. And although the Department of Energy waived its interest in those plants in 2003, the utility owners of the plants spent a whole lot of money cleaning them up with scrubbers in 2011 and 2013. And the Ohio legislature still thinks that there's a national security role for these plants, which is not true. So the picture is confusing because there's a number of different cases addressing different facets of this. As far as nuclear goes, it's a little simpler. FirstEnergy is the only nuclear utility in Ohio. A lot of FirstEnergy customers think of themselves as Toledo Edison or Cleveland Electric Illuminating or Ohio Edison. They don't know that they're FirstEnergy customers as well. So the status of all of these things is on hold, or there was a couple of Public Utility Commission agreements for very short-term bailouts that are they're in place, but they're being held up by challenges right now. That's a quick overview for what it's worth. The worst thing that is still ahead of us is that FirstEnergy has gone to the Ohio legislature, as has Dayton Power and Light, for some additional concessions that they would have to change laws to make it possible to do these things. And as far as the utility is concerned, a lawmaker is a much easier touch than the general public. So there's still a big risk that when these guys come back from their summer recesses and they start taking up the serious legislation that they're going to do, there are going to be some hairball addendums to different pieces of legislation. To his credit, Governor Kasich, and believe me, I'm not used to complimenting Republicans in Ohio, but Governor Kasich has done a very good job of vetoing most of the really bad line items in this regard. And so the message is, you need to be telling your lawmakers if you don't want bailouts, and compliment the ones who are on the right side and criticize the ones who aren't on the right side. And in the House and in the Ohio Senate, it's pretty much a partisan thing. I don't think we have a lot of good Republicans on these issues. There are a few that are worried about it because it is a lot of money. And this is the biggest point that needs to be underscored is that the money that they're asking for is enormous. They're asking for 5 to 10% rate increases to keep these plants going. They want that much money every year. That much money is so much money that it could permanently eliminate the need for these plants inside of a couple of years if it was spent on energy efficiency or renewables.
So they're talking about $4.5 billion. I think that's $300 million a year for 15 years to subsidize continued operations of the Davis-Bessey and Perry nuclear plants. Is that basically it, Paparita? You said
that's about right. And those two bills, although fortunately they haven't really passed out of committee. But the bills are in the House, they're 178, and in the Senate, they're 128. And people that are listening should call their Ohio legislators, both senator and representative, and say no to these bills. So FirstEnergy's already, as Ned said, although there's legal action against it, getting $200 million a year for 3 to 5 years, but they wanted $600 million, so that's why they've gone back and asked for this, $4.5 to $5.3 billion somewhere. So one of the members of our committee did an analysis of FirstEnergy's annual report. And crunching the numbers, he noticed that the two plants, Davis-Bessey and Perry in Ohio, were valued at $245.9 million. And, you know, and they want this, you know, billions of dollars of bailout for these plants. And they, of course, they want to sell them, and Exelon at once has expressed some interest in buying them. So, and actually also, when our expert analyzed the First Energy's 2016 annual report, said that actually the two nuclear power plants made a little money if you subtract the paper losses. They actually did show a profit, but First Energy is really losing money because of a bad deal they made buying Allegheny Energy back in 2011. So, and well, also to save money, they're not doing repairs.
They get bailed out and then they don't do anything to upgrade the plants. But they are getting
paid. That's right. Bad situation.
They are getting paid.
These are old plants. These are plants that are at the end of their first license period, and they're looking for license extensions or have applied for them. But the thing is that they can keep on operating these plants for a little while, and it costs virtually nothing to run an old plant. But they know these plants won't continue to operate unless they do major retrofits, and that's what the money is for. They don't want to claim that they're going to continue operating these plants if they know that they have to spend the money out of pocket or out of their proceeds from what the plants are earning right now. They need additional money.
But there's nothing in the bill that requires them to spend it on upgrades, so they can. It's basically just a gift to First Energy, and they call it zero emission nuclear credits, or ZENs, like saying that nuclear is carbon free, which isn't true at all. Of course, the chain reaction is nuclear free, but the fuel from uranium mining and uranium milling and enrichment. The uranium enrichment plant at Piketon initially took as much electricity as the city of Chicago. So we're talking about serious carbon emissions with nuclear power.
Right. And, of course, in the fission process, nuclear power plants do emit carbon-14, which is it is actually carbon. But the flip side of what's happening in Ohio, this is what makes it doubly important. I got to say that if Ohio turns down these bailouts, it is of huge national significance, because the industry is running around saying how wonderful it is that Illinois and New York bailed out the nuclear plants. But if Ohio says no, that's going to be a major a momentum changer. And in addition, we have this issue with wind power in Ohio. Ned, do you want to explain the setback provision and what's going on with wind power in Ohio?
Yeah. In 2014, the Republicans passed a bill called Senate Bill 310. And 310 was basically a smack at the wind and efficiency industries. Most of the attention went to that bill, but without any attention whatsoever at the time, they put in a single line in the budget bill that passed a couple of weeks later. And that single line changed the setback provision in the original law. Originally, you had to have 1,125 feet, which is just shy of a quarter of a mile, from the nearest inhabited structure. And then you had to be the height of the turbine plus 50 feet or 100 feet or something from any uninhabited property line. And they changed it so that you had to have that 1,125 feet from any property line. That doesn't sound like a lot, but if you're trying to secure rights to pieces of property to put up wind turbines and to put up enough of them to make it worth the while to put all the infrastructure in, it pretty much makes it impossible to find places in Ohio unless you wind up bribing all the neighbors, and that reduces the economic value to the point where wind developers would rather go to Pennsylvania or Indiana. And
right.
Exactly,
and it's
what's happened.
Well,
Indiana
so it's
has like four times as much wind as we do.
wind power. I mean, it's important to point out that Ohio, northern Ohio, has a tremendously attractive wind regime. There's good, steady wind in northern Ohio. The region is flat. The farmers really want these windmills. I mean, it's been established for a decade that farmers all over northern Ohio are dying to get these windmills in there to make the money. And the key is that there's a tremendous amount of transmission up there. The big problem with wind power in the Great Plains is that there's no transmission lines, and transmission is very expensive and also politically difficult to pull off. And the wind sites in northern Ohio are near the major cities. So you do get a much more economic transmission situation than in other places. And I have read, and Dad or Pat, you can confirm or deny. In fact, I talked to a reporter yesterday from the Plain Dealer who says that the American Wind Energy Association says that about $4.5 billion worth of wind development in northern Ohio is sitting there waiting for this setback provision to be done away with. Have you, Pat, have you heard that?
I'm not really familiar. I don't know the figure, but we know that there's tons of solar and wind awaiting more favorable outlook from Ohio, particularly, as you say, the wind with that huge setback.
Ohio has enough natural wind capacity. With today's technology, Ohio has enough wind to generate more than 2.25 times as much electricity as we consume. We would never
need that
much. We would probably peak out at about 40% of our consumption in wind, and the rest would come from other resources. But the thing is that between 2011 and 2012, Ohio built 400 megawatts of wind turbines. That was a $2 billion investment. We could be doing that every 6 months for the next 20 years and not run into any barriers whatsoever. And
so if the setback provision were done away with, would the wind power coming into northern Ohio displace the power from Perry and Davis Bessie?
In a heartbeat. Right now in the United States, new wind plus new solar is increasing faster than we're retiring nuclear plants. We're retiring nuclear plants at a rate slightly over one per year, a little less than two, about 1.3 plants per year. We would have to pick that up to five plants per year. Five nuclear plants per year would have to retire for us to offset the clean energy that's coming from existing wind and solar. And we still have all the efficiency, which is much bigger.
Combined how many wind jobs, Ned Ford, how many jobs would be created if the setback on the wind power was done away with in northern Ohio?
I'm not the right person to ask about jobs. I can quote what other people have said.
We have three
studies in Ohio now that say there's about 90 to 100,000 jobs in clean energy. They come down to about 14,000 of those jobs are due to wind. I have no idea. I've read the public versions of these reports, and they just don't break it down to my satisfaction. I don't know how much of that is construction and how much of that is ongoing operation. The one thing I can say for sure is that ongoing operation for wind and solar is a lot more than ongoing operation for coal and nuclear power. So they won't be the same jobs. People are going to be trained to do different things, and people who have jobs in the old industries won't be able to move over unless they're young and willing to go back to school. But there's a natural retirement rate in these industries anyhow, and the people who lose their jobs at some nuclear plants can go find their jobs at other nuclear plants as the nation slowly grows beyond the nuclear era.
Pat, go ahead.
Yeah, at the hearings on these two bailout bills, one of the major reasons for them was to say, oh, we need all these nuclear jobs. But what we tried to get across to them was that if these plants shut down and they had decommissioning, they could hire back the workers working on decommissioning, that immediate decommissioning would cost less than postponing it, and that also keeping those same workers, it would be safer because these workers know the plant rather than waiting, you know, 10 or 15 years, letting that waste just sit there without doing anything important about it, but rather hire the workers that know the plant. So it's not necessarily mean that everybody would have to lose a job.
Well, my understanding is it's about 600 jobs each at Perry and Davis Bessie. Is that right? Between 600 and 700 each?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the incoming of the wind would create thousands of jobs. Is that right?
Well, another thing about the wind is that the cost of wind and the cost of solar power have plummeted over the last 20 years. And in the last 4 or 5 years, they've actually crossed the point where coal and natural gas are competing. And most of the people in Ohio pay electric rates that are determined by where coal and natural gas compete with each other. If you go online to the Apples and Apples website and you select your own power, you're going to be given a price to compare, which should be printed on your bill. I haven't seen my bill for 6 years because it goes into my computer and I don't read it. I know it's supposed to be there. And that price to compare is the wholesale price of electricity that you're being charged. It runs between 5 and 5.5 cents per kilowatt hour in Ohio. And the rest of what you pay is the distribution fee. There are two different companies involved. You can select your supplier. You can't select your distributor. But this is because Ohio is deregulated, we have this ability to make choices. It also gives us a lot of information about what competing resources are doing. So we can get the public prices that are being set by these wholesale auctions where we know what the utility is paying for electricity. Like I said, it's about 5.5 cents. Maybe it's dropped in the last year or so. It's in that neighborhood. And we've had a contract for wind in Ohio since 2012 for 4.2 cents. They've never been real eager to make it public, and we don't know who it is that has that contract. But wind has been selling underneath the market for a long time in Ohio, and the prices keep getting lower. In fact, the wind industry itself says when the federal tax credit expires in 2021, they're done. They don't need any more tax subsidy.
So what do you
think? And that contract with the bailouts where they're asking for more subsidies without offering to build anything new.
Well, so if I assume it wouldn't take more than 12 to 24 months to put in the windmills that would supplant the nukes. So what do you have any estimate of what the price of electricity would be generated by wind power in northern Ohio versus the price that's being charged at the nuclear plants?
I can tell you that people would not experience a rate increase. Technically, you should get a rate decrease from moving to wind, but it's a very small rate decrease, and we're talking about Davis & Bessie provides 5 or 6% of all the electricity in Ohio. And you spread that over all the people in Ohio, and you spread it over a couple of years, you're not going to notice it, and other prices, other parts of the cost of electricity are probably going to increase at the same time as the generation cost gets a little lower. It won't raise rates. And the most exciting thing about wind is that all the turbines in Ohio are now between 80 and 90 meters high at the hub, at the center point of the blade. And when they get to be about 20 or 30 meters higher, a much bigger part of the state of Ohio becomes economic for wind, and the best places for wind become a lot more profitable. So there's a real race going on to these taller turbines. In Europe, all the turbines that are being built now are much taller than anything we have in this country. And that's they're calling for new construction techniques. They have to build the tower on site out of concrete and steel because you can't put that big a tower on a truck and drive it anywhere. And it's a coming industry that it's going to be a mind-boggling amount of economic growth, and it will reduce the cost of electricity. Like I said, whether or not it reduces it so much that we actually see lower bills, I can't predict that because there's too many other things involved. But there's another thing about the need for those nuclear plants that everybody has to understand. Davis-Besse is, you guys know this better than me, what is it, about 800 megawatts, 890 megawatts? Is that right?
I'm not sure. It sounds about right.
Yeah. Within 20 miles of Davis-Besse, there is a new natural gas facility going in called the Oregon Natural Gas Plant. Or is it Oregonia? It's 20 miles away from Davis-Besse, and it's 1,000 megawatts, and it's online later this year. The same thing is true a little bit later in Perry territory, and not quite as close, but there's more natural gas plants being built. There is no capacity shortage whatsoever when you take into consideration the natural gas plants that are being built. Of course, the natural gas industry doesn't want to see clean energy any more than the nuclear folks do.
But
we're in a position to be able to say
they were
fight it out on economic grounds.
Now, this kind of thing's going on all over the country, where I mean, it's astounding to hear that they're building a natural gas plant that big, that close to Perry, to Davis-Besse, at the same time that the utility is asking for a bailout for Davis-Besse, when it can also be supplanted within a year or a year and a half by wind power that will create more jobs and come in cheaper. Is that a reasonable statement to make?
Yeah, well, they're hoping that nobody notices.
Well, hopefully we'll cure that with this radio show. Pat, you also wanted to talk about very quickly, and this is again a national deal, radioactive waste situation legislatively. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, well, we call it the Dump Nuclear Waste Anywhere Bill. It's actually the Nuclear Waste Policy Amendments Act of 2017. But short for it would be bill number 3053 in the House. And it's dealing with disposing of high-level radioactive waste from commercial nuclear power plants. And it was just introduced into the U.S. House on June 26th, although we've been watching the drafts of it for some time. Republicans, of course, are behind this bill that have written it. And it's likely it could be voted in the House very soon. It was voted out of committee 49-4. So we're very clear that the Democrats don't understand what's really bad about this bill. It would smooth the way for Yucca Mountain, and it would also allow for private for-profit companies to make bids to take the waste. They don't have oversight, and they don't have site-specific environmental review. Don't need those, according to this bill. Now we have besides Yucca Mountain, there are corporations in Texas and New Mexico that have applied to take the waste. So hey, we can make money taking the waste. We'll apply. In fact, the bill would give these corporations public money, even if no waste is sent there. And I don't know
God.
How much more time you have. I could talk a long time about
well,
it. But there's environmental.
Bill, is that right?
I mean, there's environmental justice issues, putting this on Native American land and so forth. And one of the worst things is that it preempts states' rights to water rights and air rights, although that's as the draft of this bill is in Congress, it's being taken out and then put back in.
Oh, God. So this is a federal law. What's the bill number?
3053, and everybody should call their senators and their U.S. member of Congress and say no to this, because it would create like interim storage. So that would mean someplace for like a temporary storage. Well, if there's temporary storage, it means that it either stays there or it has to be moved a second time, which and it doesn't even need to be moved in the first place. And the maps that are out there show going nuclear waste coming through your town, tens of thousands of shipments could happen, and a lot of it would be through northern Ohio and Cleveland area.
And this is so what we're talking about here, and what the I think there is something of a consensus among critics of the nuclear industry that what really has to happen to this waste is that very substantial containers or casks need to be built at each nuclear site, and that the rods and whatever other trash they have has to sit securely in these rods, in these things. Is this Mark Sommer joining us?
Yes, it is, Mark.
Okay, great. Mark, we're talking about nuclear waste, and then we're going to segue over to you to talk about small grids, microgrids, and we hope that Pat and Pat Morita of the Ohio Sierra Club and Ned Ford of the Ohio Sierra Club can stay with us, because microgrids are also worth discussing, of course, here in Ohio. But to deal with this nuclear waste issue, I have been in Yucca Mountain in Nevada. I have seen the earthquake fault that goes right through it. And when people talk about Yucca Mountain, and the high finding a centralized high-level nuclear waste dump, the one thing you got to remember to start with is in 2008, the official estimate for finishing Yucca Mountain was $96 billion. I mean, you know, and 10 years of construction. Now, if this act, and you're talking about, Pat, the Congress sets an interim, I mean, that's basically what they want to do is build a big parking lot and just sit the stuff there. You know, it still involves moving that stuff all over the place, and it means that stuff is just going to be out there in the open, vulnerable to all sorts of stuff. Is that right?
Well, I think at Yucca Mountain, they're planning to actually put it down inside the mountain, and it would be, if it went there, it would almost essentially mean abandonment. The waste has heat, even though it's in canisters. And so, but the rocks out there have a lot of water in them, so that the heat from the canisters would drive the water in the rocks away. But then as the canisters cool down, the water in the rocks would come back and rust the canisters. And so there's a lot of danger of compromise of any canisters over a long period of time at Yucca Mountain. And that's why that's a big scientific reason why it's unsuitable.
Well, I've also seen there was a major study done that warned that if you stuck to 70,000 tons, and they want to up it now to 110,000 tons of high-level radioactive waste inside Yucca Mountain, it would eventually generate enough heat and steam just to blow the place up. And, you know, we've already had an explosion at the Waste Isolation Pilot Project in New Mexico where that blew up. That was in 2014, it cost $2 billion, shut the place for 3 years, and contaminated about two dozen workers. And I'm sure that the Yucca Mountain, after the 20, 30 years and $250 billion that they spent there, would also blow up. And that would be a lot bigger. We're talking this is the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We've been talking with Pat Morita and Ned Ford about the situation in Ohio, which is a landmark state here, because if Ohio defeats the requested bailout by FirstEnergy for its two nukes in northern Ohio and also for Beaver Valley near Pittsburgh, that would be a major momentum changer, I think, for the national campaign to bail out all these old reactors. And as Ned has pointed out, Ned Ford has pointed out, the wind power coming into northern Ohio, which has been held back by a ridiculous restriction on just, thrown in at the last minute into a budget bill. We have $4.5 billion of wind development being on hold as a result of this restriction, siting restriction, which really needs to go. If that $4.5 billion of wind development was unleashed in northern Ohio, it would provide way more capacity, way cheaper, and create far more jobs than the continued operation of those two nuclear plants. Is that a fair statement, Ned Ford?
The $4.5 billion is only what's already been permitted. We could be building that much every year for the next 20 years because of the need and the wind potential in Ohio. Ohio is in actually a very good position to develop onshore wind. Onshore wind will always be cheaper than offshore wind. How much, I can't say because we don't have enough experience with offshore wind. But onshore wind is already economic in most of the United States, and it continues to get cheaper. And in Ohio, we have enough electricity potential to generate more electricity than we use. We could be selling electricity from wind to states to the east, which don't have as good wind as Ohio does.
Right, and it's not as close to transmission lines, which is a critical piece
right.
of the puzzle. So another
Ohio has got all the transmission lines we could ever use.
Right, and so we haven't even really talked about offshore wind. In Lake Erie, if you look at wind maps, Lake Erie is dead purple. I mean, there's no better wind regime in the world, really, than the middle of Lake Erie. And we've been talking about putting windmills there for a long, long time, but that's been on hold, too. I want to segue now to Mark Sommer, another Ohio boy. This is an all-Ohio program here. Although I do have to admit to my listeners that I went to the University of Michigan, and there is a weekend in Ohio in the fall where it is literally suicidal to wear any regalia from the University of Michigan. So I do avoid that. Mark, who grew up in Columbus, knows full well, and Pat is here in Columbus, and I'm sure, Ned, you're aware of that too. But Mark, you have been working on microgrids. And one of the things that would translate from the wind energy that we expect to come into northern Ohio would be going into places like Cleveland and Toledo and installing microgrids. So can you tell us a bit about this technology and how it works?
Yeah. Microgrids have been around, think small grid, basically, although it's also less complex than a large power grid. But microgrids have been around probably for two or three decades, mostly on military bases and mostly powered by fossil fuels like diesel generators. And basically they consist of a sort of self-contained power generation system that will provide electricity to a number of buildings, often in remote situations, where getting the main power grid out there is just too expensive. In more recent years, over the last several years, photovoltaics or solar arrays have been paired with energy storage, usually in the form of lithium-ion batteries, and then with an inverter to convert the energy from DC, direct current, which is what is generated by the solar panels, to alternating current, which is what we get out of our sockets in the walls and what powers our conventional grid. And so what's happening is that microgrids are beginning to be experimented with around the United States in situations, mostly in remote situations, but a few of them are landing in urban environments. For example, the Marcus Garvey Village in Brooklyn, a mixed-income community where they have experimented with putting one in. What it does is enable that particular neighborhood to be to have a kind of standby self-reliance, so that if anything goes wrong with the main grid, they're not stranded. They have their own alternative source of power, and it's powered by the sun, so they're not depending on fossil fuels that would, you know, that might themselves be impaired if there were a larger power grid breakdown. Now, my wife and I moved back to the land in Northern California off the grid along with hundreds of our neighbors back in the late 70s. And we just so happened to connect with an enterprising young man who found the earliest solar panels being manufactured. At the time, they were being built by ExxonMobil and Arco and used in remote oil rigs offshore. But we adapted them for our own use, early solar panels with deep cycle golf cart batteries and inverters. And we didn't call them microgrids at the time, but they worked perfectly fine for us for all those years. And those initial panels are still pumping out electricity 37 years later. And the power would go out in towns hours away, but we didn't even know that was happening. We still had energy. So there are many reasons why you would want to go to microgrids, but one of the most compelling now is that there are rapidly increasing instances of disruption of the main power grids due to both climate-related storm disruptions and, most menacingly, from cyber attacks from criminal gangs and also from individual hackers and, most of all, from nation-states like Russia. Not everything can be traced back to Russia by any means, but it is becoming a form of warfare co-equal with other forms of more conventional warfare. In fact, the Russian military doctrine now calls it hybrid warfare. And instead of blowing things up, it's about shutting things down. And in recent weeks, the Department of Homeland Security and FBI issued an Amber Alert, second highest level of alert, that the a group of hackers believed to be connected with the Russian government penetrated 12 nuclear power plants in the United States in the last few months and were apparently mapping them with intent to eventually attack. There has been penetration of the U.S. power grid in a variety of places for several years now. Now, we should not say that this is a one-sided thing. The United States is doing the same in Russia, China, in Iran, where it actually destroyed a number of centrifuges several years ago. Cyber warfare is actually occurring now in a very widespread way, and it's becoming more and more lethal. An article in Wired magazine, a cover story in June, I believe, made the point that since 2014, Ukraine has been experiencing widespread and devastating cyber attacks believed to have come from Russia that have not only shut down its critical infrastructure, but have also erased financial records and health and medical records and created chaos throughout Ukraine. The article itself says that these are essentially testing grounds for what will eventually be used in the United States.
How would microgrids fight that? And could we use the windmills in northern Ohio to build some kind of firewall or wind wall to protect us in Ohio from this kind of cyber attack. Where is the
idea of microgrids is that instead of having a few very large targets, like large local utilities that are rich targets for hackers, you essentially atomize the system. That is to say, you turn it into many microgrids that are self-reliant, though interconnected, but they are capable of being entirely independent when they need to be. And if any one of them is attacked, it doesn't spread to others. Whereas in a large macro grid that a utility owns, it's much harder to stop it from shutting down an entire region. You can power it on wind, you can power it on solar. You do not want to power it on something like diesel. After all, if the grid goes down, then you're not going to be able to get fuel to it. Whereas if you have wind or solar, it is self-contained and will continue to generate no matter what happens around it.
And you have battery backup to deal with that,
yes,
to deal with the intermittency and also with the attack mode. Now,
yes,
is this a model that is adaptable to wind power? Is there anyone working with this? Would we see this coming in northern Ohio?
Yes, you certainly could adapt it to wind. It's just as adaptable as solar. It's the system is pretty generic. You just plug in whatever renewable source you have available. Geothermal could be used. A lot of different things could be used. The reason I suggest solar is simply because solar is the easiest one to use in dense urban environments. And the reason I focus on dense urban environments is because they are both the most dependent on technology and the most information rich. In other words, if you wanted to devastate an area or paralyze a region or a country, you would aim at the urban centers to shut them down. The communications, the transportation, the health services, the media, the food and fuel, a variety of different systems that are all concentrated in the centers of cities and in the industrial areas. So you want to do them in those places. Up to now, as I say, it's been mostly applied in here and there in very remote places. There are only about 170 in the entire country that are powered by renewable energy. But the amazing thing is that if you go to solar trade shows these days, they're huge events. I just went to one yesterday in San Francisco. They're immense events, and they have major companies like Siemens and Hitachi and others from around the world that are beginning to peddle the components of microgrids, because they understand that these are a viable and inexpensive way to create a kind of robust and resilient and redundant accompaniment to the main grid, and to some extent a replacement for parts of it. More and more energy needs to be decentralized and solarized or wind used. I think it's primarily solarized in order to create this kind of robustness. You know, the old paradigm or the old way of thinking is basically a mechanistic, hierarchical power coming down from the top generating system and transmission system. But the newer way of thinking is actually a biological metaphor. It's strengthening our collective immune system. And you do that in the same way that a forest consists of many trees that grow independently, but below the ground, their roots intertwine, and the fungi among them enable trees of different species to be mutually assistive of each other, to support one another. So what you're doing at the same time that you're building microgrids in each neighborhood and around every essential service is that you're rebuilding community, because these microgrids would not only be local people, but they would be funded and financed through bonds that the cities themselves issue, and that local people, the bonds, solar savings bonds, I call them, would be issued in denominations small enough, $100, $250, $75, small enough that people of any income could afford to buy them and then receive interest over time that is much better than what a bank can give, and that that is an alternative to going into a stock market that we all know is invested in all the wrong things. So it,
wow.
It, think so of it as a community building cycle.
That's fantastic stuff. I mean, do we see solar panels and windmills dispersed around, say, Cleveland or Toledo that would result in a network of microgrids? Ned Ford, have you ever had that a vision?
Yeah, and you know, Harvey, this is not something that is a utopian kind of dream that we could do in 20 years. What one hears from the major companies is they are prepared to do this in a matter of months.
Months. Really?
And the cost is not high. The cost is much, much lower than rebuilding the entire transmission lines in order to be able to take solar. You don't have to do that. Power lines of great distances are no longer necessary. They're antiquated. We don't need to spend that money. The principle is to go local and to generate it all right where you're going to be using it. The only major thing that utilities are really going to be needed for is energy storage on a massive scale. Local microgrids will be able to store enough through batteries for, say, 4 or 5 days. But if there's going to be a major power outage over time, you want the major utilities to have enough to last a month or two. And for those, you need things like pumped hydro and large thermal installations, things like that. Where,
well, of course, we in Ohio are very familiar with blackouts, since First Energy caused the one of the biggest in history. Ned Ford, do you hear this resonating at all in Ohio and Tappan Zee?
Well, one of the things that happened after that blackout was that the PJM, which is the regional system operator, sort of the federal government's agent for 14 states in the Midwest, changed rules and required First Energy to build about $1 billion worth of transmission lines. So that backup, the blackout, is very unlikely to happen again. The thing that fascinates me about this evolution that we're going through is that we now have three technologies that are cheaper than the conventional power sources. We've got wind, solar, and efficiency. And the potential for efficiency remains enormous. The combination of the three, I believe, is going to edge fossil fuels and nuclear power out a lot further than some people are imagining, because I don't think we're going to see huge gaps between wind and solar. We're going to see little gaps, and those little gaps will be filled with things that are already being developed on the scale of the microgrid for reasons of power quality more than for reasons of transporting power from one time of day to another. And the important thing is that this battery storage that's occurring now is coming in so cheap that it actually looks as if it will be ready when we need it. I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of need to make special investments in energy storage. I could be wrong about that, but from my point of view, there are companies that are developing 50 and 100 megawatt energy storage plants all over the world today. And they're doing it not because they want to save wind energy or save solar energy and move it to a different time of day to use.
they're doing it because they want to smooth out the second by second and the microsecond variations in the grid. Dayton Power and Light, down right on Interstate 75, right south of 70, has a 20 megawatt energy storage facility, which I got to tour about a year ago. It looks like five semi-trailers parked along the side of the freeway. And what they do with that is, and 20 megawatts is like, you know, it's enough to power, a megawatt is enough to power 1,000 houses, and 20 is obviously enough to power 20,000 houses. They use it because when 16 different corporations flip the light switch on in the morning and their lights all come on, it makes the power surge up and down, zigzag, zigzag. And they use it to eliminate that variability so that everybody has a more stable supply. The design discharge, it's amazing. This design discharge for this 20 megawatts, five semi-trailers full of Tesla batteries. They're actually filled with the first-generation Tesla batteries, is 30 seconds. So they put 20 – they don't do it like that all the time. What they do most of the time is much smaller steps up and down. But they have the capacity to dump 20 megawatts in 30 seconds.
And that requires – to really make full use of that, you'll want a microgrid. You'll want to be, you know, in a sort of restricted area. We're almost to the end. Ned Ford, you're with Sierra Club. Is there a way for people to contact you that you want to be contacted? Maybe not.
I don't have an easy way to do that. People can look me up on the internet and they'll find me.
All right, Ned Ford of the Ohio Sierra. Pat Morita, do you want to chip in, and then we'll finish with Mark Sommer? Oh, I think Pat may be gone. Pat Morita from the Ohio Sierra Club Nuclear Committee. Thanks for being with us. Mark Sommer, you want to sum up here? We just got a minute or two. And how do people get a hold of you?
People can reach me at Mark, M-A-R-K, at Solarizing. It's SolarIsing.net. And I also have a Facebook.
Is it Summer or Summer? Is it with a U or an O?
It's an O. It's S-O-M-M-E-R, Mark, M-A-R-K.
Okay. And SolarRising.com, right?
SolarRising.net.
Okay. So finish up with this here. We've gone through how Ohio can shut its nuclear reactors, get rid of the setback requirement, bring in wind power, create thousands of jobs, cheaper energy, the whole deal. Where does the end of this, actually, the cherry on the top is the microgrid. So how do you envision places like Ohio segueing into a world that's run on microgrids?
I think, Harvey, that this is a proposition that is a right now proposition. That is to say, I think that this needs to be taken to every city council, every planning commission in every city in Ohio as a very practical proposal.
Uh-oh. That's going to be the last word. Mark Sommer, Ned Ford, Pat Morita, thank you. We'll see you next week in Solartopia.
Either way, we got...